Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey there, cynical listeners. Kaiser here. Since May, when SubChina began hosting our podcast, we've been telling you about the SubChina app and newsletter. If you're at all interested in China, these are tremendously useful tools for you. In just a few minutes, you'll be brought up to date on all the important China news from the last 24 hours, complete with links to original stories in the global and Chinese press. So go and download the app and subscribe to the newsletter. The app is on the Apple App Store and on Google Play, and you can sign up for the daily newsletter at supchina.com. Let us know what you think, and on with the show. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is a great way to stay on top of China news in a few minutes a day with a daily email newsletter, a mobile phone app, and at the website supchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We're coming to you today from Oakland, California. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined as usual by Jeremy Goldkorn, the fifth horseman of the apocalypse. How are you, Jeremy?
We're doing very well, as always, Kaiser.
What is your specialty? I mean, you're not like plague.
Death and destruction.
Okay, right. You kind of cover all the things that the other horsemen don't. Well, so today, actually, we have a very different guest, somebody who's spent time actually behind bars, both in Beijing at the number one detention center and in New Jersey here in the U.S., in the Northern State Prison in North New Jersey, both for nonviolent cannabis-related offenses. Michael Manning previously wrote a blog in China about his experiences in Xinjiang called Opposite End of China. It's still online, actually, at china.notspecial.org. And some of our listeners, may remember that blog from back in the period from about 2005 through 2007, before Michael actually moved to Beijing. Michael has very generously agreed to chat with us about his experiences. Nothing off limits. So, Jeremy, you know Michael. You guys go back a ways.
Yeah, we met. I mean, we knew each other online when Dan Wei was a big part of the blogging scene. And, you know, Michael was the only English language blogger writing a blog from the point of view of someone living in Xinjiang, which was really interesting. And, you know, that blogging scene was small enough that I guess there were like maybe 20 blogs that were consistently written about right. China in English. And we pretty much all knew each other. So I guess that's how we met online. And then you moved to Beijing, right, Michael?
Yeah, more importantly for me, I didn't have any friends when I moved to Beijing. So I hit up all of my blog contacts and became friends with a number of them. All right. Among them.
Yeah, so I mean, the blog is worth checking out, but what we're going to talk about today is, you know, some of the interesting experiences you had a bit later. So why don't you tell us how you ended up in Beijing number one detention center?
All right, so I had lived in Xinjiang from 2005 to 2007, and while I was there, I had become friends with a lot of Uyghurs. I was also a big fan of smoking hash, cannabis. I mean, that's my career now, and it had been part of my career in the United States before that.
What do you mean by it's your career now? I mean,
I work in the cannabis industry here in the United States. I currently work at Magnolia Wellness, a cannabis dispensary here in Oakland, California. But I've also worked at High Times in the past simultaneously while I was working at NBC News. I kind of lived in both worlds a lot of my life, but now I'm firmly on the cannabis side now that I'm free and living here in California. But at that time, when I moved to Beijing in 2008, I didn't know a lot of people. I was smoking a lot of hash from my Uyghur friends in Xinjiang, and I brought a bunch with me. I started sharing it with my newfound friends. Everybody told me I had the best hash around, much better. I don't know what's going on now in Beijing, but at that time it was kind of Nigerians running things in Sanlitun, selling this shoe polish, incense, opium crap that everybody hated. Everybody loved my hash in Beijing. I made a lot of new friends, and I started importing hash from Korla, where I lived in Xinjiang, to Beijing, and selling it on the side while I was working at CCTV.
So how are you actually importing it?
Well, it was, I mean, it was in the country already, but it was in Xinjiang in Korla, where I had lived for 3 years, and I had a lot of friends there. I would fly across the country. I would talk to my friends and, you know, get a kilo, 2 kilos. I would buy one of those home stereo systems that are very cheap in China, you know, with a subwoofer and 2 side speakers. I'd rip out the guts of the subwoofer, stuff the hash inside. I would send it to myself via China mail and fly back to Beijing and receive it. And,
you know, that was that.
That was that.
So how did you end up getting caught then?
I mean, I'd done it a bunch of times, and I guess getting comfortable is always when people get caught. I mean, both times I've been caught in the United States and in China, it's when I got comfortable. But I just believe that I don't know 100%, because in China, you never do. Yeah, you never do. I mean, they don't have, in the US, you get discovery, you kind of get the evidence from the police, what they have against you. In China, they don't tell you anything.
Right.
But what I believe is that it was just profiled as a large package from Xinjiang to Beijing, and kind of, you know, subject to extra security, maybe an x-ray. And if it was x-rayed, then they would see 2 large, you know, bricks of something stuffed inside the subwoofer that didn't belong there.
Right. So I assume you understood that was illegal, but did you know what the sorts of penalties were that you might face if you were caught?
I definitely knew it was illegal, and I definitely did not know what the penalties were. In fact, after I got arrested and thrown into Beijing No. 1 detention center, it took at least a month before my lawyer was even able to tell me what type of time I was facing. The big question was what amount triggered sort of an automatic conviction. They don't have in China what we have in the United States usually, which is possession with intent to distribute. They have possession for personal use, and they have distribution or dealing drugs. And it turned out that the limit was 2,000 grams or 2 kilos for hash, which just so happened to be the exact amount that I had purchased in Xinjiang and sent to myself in Beijing.
So if they leaned on the scale, then you were guilty of a more serious offense. And if they didn't, then you scraped
exactly. And
just under the limit.
I was pretty certain that I was going to be convicted. Well, first of all, because China has, you know, 99.99% conviction rate or something along those lines. The whole time that I was in the detention center, I never saw one person released, you know, sort of to freedom, like, oh, we made a mistake, you know, sorry, you're innocent, you're going. Everybody who I knew the whole time was convicted, and
let's go back a step, Michael. So what happened? How exactly were you caught?
Okay, so I was working at CCTV 9 at the time, and I was working overnight shifts this particular week. And I came home from the shift in the morning. I was wondering where my package was. I knew it was supposed to be there the day before, but I figured it would get there the next day. I went to sleep at about 8 in the morning, and at about 10 in the morning, I got a call from China Post saying I had a package they wanted to deliver, just making sure I was home, that sort of thing, which I found a bit odd because that's not the usual procedure. But I have actually received calls from China Post in the past. I then went back to sleep for a little while, and there was a knock at my door about a half an hour later. And when I got up, I was groggy. It was overnight. I mean, I did think it was odd that I lived in a tall building with security and everything like that. I did think it was a little odd that they hadn't buzzed up, but people always let people in the door and things like that. So it's, you know, you can shrug off inconsistencies. You're always worried. If you're a drug dealer, you're always worried and you're always paranoid. So you learn to ignore things that you think are wrong, because usually they're not wrong. So it was actually 2 delivery guys came up to the door. They gave me the package. They had me sign the paperwork. They slid the package inside the door, just inside the door frame, actually, kind of so you couldn't slam the door shut, right. I figure. I went to take the package out of the door frame, kind of slide it in after I'd given them the paperwork, and I turned to my right to rotate the package, you know, out of the doorway. And as I rotated back to the door to close it, I saw just a whole bunch of guys running towards me.
Uniformed or?
No, plainclothes police. And I knew what was, I knew what was going on. But seriously, it was the worst feeling I've ever had in my life.
I can imagine.
I mean, it was just the bottom of your stomach dropping out all the way, like kind of what I imagine it's like when you're in a lion's jaws and you give up hope on life or something like that. You're kind of just, it just all drains right out of you.
Previous to this, you'd had no real run-ins with law enforcement, either here in the States or in China?
I had spent a night in jail in New York in 2000. I had been in a marijuana protest that Rudy Giuliani, who was mayor at the time, in previous years, nobody had gotten arrested. And that year, he decided to arrest pretty much everybody who they saw smoking. So I think the previous year, 15 people had been arrested. The year I got arrested, there was 312 people arrested. But it was expunged from my record later.
Okay.
So the guys arrive at your door, and then what happens?
So they run on through. You know, they kind of just sit me down on the ground, and I have this memory, you know, the cleaning lady had been there the day before. My fake wood floors were completely like a mirror, and these guys all ran in with their dusty shoes and the dusty footprints all over the place. And they were followed by a woman with a camera, and they just start tossing the whole place. They're just looking around everywhere, and they're videotaping me, and they're asking me, like, you know why we're here? You know why we're here? And I'm like thinking, I worked at CCTV at the time, and I'm thinking, like, oh my God, this is going to be on CCTV tonight. Like, footage of some American caught with a large quantity of drugs. And they just asked me, you know, if I knew why they were there. And I said, I mean, I probably should have said nothing, because that's always the best idea when you're dealing with the police in any case. But I was like, yes, I know, it's the drugs, whatever. It didn't matter. I knew I was in China. It didn't matter, like, what you say. I don't think so. They opened up the package.
They don't read you Miranda rights here.
Exactly. Right? They didn't need me to admit it. They weren't going to leave if I didn't.
Did they inform you that you were under arrest at that point?
I don't remember anything like that. I mean, I just was distraught.
Right. I can imagine.
I was just distraught, and I had been sleeping too. It was, you know, in the morning after working all night. So they basically looked around my place for a while. They collected everything. They found all the hash, and I had these 2 kilos of hash in the package, but there were also bits and containers all over the house. And there were, pipes, things like that, whatever. They found it all. And they also took my laptop and things like that and my phone, and told me to get some clothes on and brought me downstairs, put me in a car, and took me to the local narcotics task force kind of headquarters.
R2. Right.
Yeah, it was, I guess, I've forgotten a lot about Beijing, but whatever, like Beijing, it was something like Beijing Northeast Drug Task Force, like headquarters. It was a small police station, but it was the drug task force, it was their building alone. And it just looked like a small, tiny police station. And I remember I'd been in there for maybe half an hour. I really had to go to the bathroom. Whenever I'm very nervous or in a lot of trouble or something like that, I have to pee all the time. And they took me to go to the bathroom, and we're walking in the hallway, and I see this huge pile of hash, like, sitting in this hallway. And I'm like, oh my God, they got another guy with a huge pile of hash, you know? And they were like, oh no, that's your hash. Like, we opened it up. Like, that's all your hash poured out, you know, onto this table here. They just kind of asked me a few questions. I mean, if you're smart, when you get with police, when police start asking you a lot of questions, I mean, you kind of play dumb. I mean, what else can you do? You know, you're guilty. You know, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. So, I mean, the best thing about being interrogated by Chinese people as an American who understands a decent amount of Chinese, at the time at least, is that you can really play dumb convincingly. You can use translators against them. You can say, like, sorry, I didn't understand the question. Do you mean this? Do you mean that? And all the time you're thinking of, you know, a good answer. Right away, they want to know how much it is, who you're selling to, like, what you're doing with it, who you're hanging out with. They're trying to establish your network of friends and get enough for you to be guilty. But the thing that works against the investigation, it seemed to me, at least in China, is that each stage is separate. I was at this small police station, and from what I can tell, everything that they got me to confess is only used to be able to send me to the detention center. And at the detention center, I met my interrogating officer, who would be my interrogating officer throughout my entire case when they brought me there late at night. So I'd been arrested in the morning, and I stayed in the little substation for the narcotics task force all day. Then they brought me to this hospital that's right on the corner of the highway to Bottling Great Wall. Uh-huh. I think terrible, terrible hospital where people come in from the countryside to try to get, you know, treatment for their terrible cancers and ailments. Like, this ground floor where we drove in, just sick people lying everywhere. They want to test you to see if you have various diseases and AIDS, which one of the things that we ended up talking about while I was in detention a lot was, the rumor is, and I never got to confirm if it was true or not, but the rumor is that if you're a foreigner arrested in China and you test positive for HIV And I mean, I'm sure that it's not, the crime isn't multiple murder, that they'll send you home, that they just don't want to deal with you. So,
you were just hoping.
It's just something that, you know, guys talk about, when they're locked up, like, oh man, if you could if only I had AIDS. If only you had some, you know, something you could inject into your blood to get a little positive test, you know, at that moment, it could send you home.
God.
So then they took you to the hospital and then.
They took me to the hospital. They did blood tests and then they took me to the detention center around 10, 11 at night. When we got there, we went to some building outside the jail where it was kind of an administrative building. They took me up to the top floor into a big conference room and I met my interrogating officer who would remain my interrogating officer throughout my entire time there, plus some interns or something that he was. Teaching how to be police.
Oh, okay. So they were sort of watching.
They were like, no, like he was writing down my interrogation, and then there were kind of two or three guys who looked like they were about 16 years old, also trying to write it down perfectly, and he was kind of correcting them and making them rewrite it, and it took hours and hours and hours.
So that night, you arrive there late at night, and the interrogation starts.
It starts right then. They get down your story then, like, where, you know, where are you coming from? Where are you selling to? And
are you handcuffed at this point? Are you in any kind of restraint or?
I was handcuffed. I was handcuffed going there in the police car for sure. I don't remember being handcuffed in the conference room. I probably was. It was pretty strange actually because, I mean, I could see the jail next to it, but we went into this ancillary building that was looked like a typical third-rate Chinese like office building with, you know, Baroque furniture and, you know, big wood tables and stuff like that. And we went up to the nice conference room where I'm sure the people in charge of the jail receive local leaders and things like that. And we did this whole thing. They offered me water and I got through my first confession or whatever. I got through my first interrogation. I got my story down for the first time. So when they finished interrogating me in this office building, they actually led me outside. And one of the features of Beijing number one detention center is that it has these huge doors, like the kind of doors that you imagine on the outside of a real prison, like Shawshank Redemption or something like that, these 40-foot steel doors. And they actually make you stand on a line, carry your possessions, put it down on the line, stand on this line while they go in through like a regular people's entrance. And then they open these doors for you to walk into.
For
the dramatic effect. I mean, it is a very dramatic effect, especially like midnight on your first day of incarceration in China.
At this point, they had not given you an opportunity to call the embassy, to call a lawyer.
Nothing like that.
Did you ask for this?
I didn't ask for it. But I really was actually, it's funny, I was most worried about my job that first morning. I was kind of like, oh my God.
Your job at China Central Television.
Yeah, I was like, oh man, I got to call them and tell them I'm not going to be there. Like, I just, I don't know why I was worried about that, but that's who I was thinking about calling. I was like, oh man, I should really call work.
Not call mom, call CCTV.
Yeah. Wow. But they led me inside and led me to a room where I had to take off all my clothes and they locked it in a bag and they gave me a uniform to wear. It was just mid-March, so it was still cold. So we got we still were wearing padded uniforms.
Uh-huh.
They have seasonal uniforms in Chinese jails, kind of for fall, for winter and spring. They have a padded uniform, and then for the fall and spring, they have a kind of a short sleeve shirt and a regular pants. And then in the summer, they give you just a vest to wear because everyone just sits around in their boxers.
Okay.
So
is the facility heated?
No, there's no heat. There's no air conditioning. And if you're familiar with Beijing, you know, it's like not comfortable either time in winter or the summer.
Right. There's about 2 weeks of the year when it's
exactly
tolerable.
So they lead me up to this room and it's got to be 1 a.m. and they open the door to the cell and all the lights are on. And so I'm confused because I'm thinking, like, why are all the lights on? Like, why is everybody up this late at night? I go in there and I'm also carrying, I forgot to say, they gave me also 2 blankets. That's what you get, two blankets in uniform. And I'm carrying these 2 blankets. I go in. The number one wakes up. He kind of says, like, oh, you're new here. What'd you do? He moves a couple guys over who are on the floor and gives me the spot on the floor, concrete floor right next to the bathroom. And I lay that blanket on the ground. I lay a blanket on top of me and I try to go to sleep and I'm just like cold and crying and lying on the floor next to the bathroom and the lights are on. And I'm like,
when you say bathroom, you mean like a toilet? Sorry.
So, people who are familiar with some Chinese soap operas and things like that, when the people go to jail, it is pretty accurate description. When you see all these guys sitting kind of on a bench next to each other, and the room is about 40 feet long and maybe 20 feet wide. There was anywhere between 12 and 15 guys in there at a time.
Oh, Lord.
Half Chinese, half foreigners. And one section, one whole wall pretty much was divided off with glass. And behind that was a faucet up high for showering, a squat toilet, and a hand faucet for washing clothes or washing your hands. But it was just glass. So, I mean, it was a bathroom. You could shower and stuff in there, but you saw everybody shower, you saw everybody take a shit, you saw everybody do everything all the time. So you get very intimate and very close to the people you're in that room with. I mean, you're with them all the time.
You said it was about half foreigners. Why such a high proportion of foreigners? Was this unusual for this detention center? Or,
well, so they have a Beijing number one detention center is the place where they have where they send kind of the biggest criminal cases in Beijing. You know, down in the other wings, there's murderers and the rapists and the cannibals and all that sort of stuff. This wing that they put all foreigners in is for Chinese white collar criminals. It's all corrupt businessmen, you know, tax evasion, people selling the same apartment to hundreds of people, all that kind of stuff. But the biggest ones, there was somebody from the Beijing water department who was, you know, accused of stealing millions of dollars of water, that sort of thing.
There were some sort of celebs in there as well, weren't there?
We also had, down the hallway from me was at one time the richest man in China, the CEO of Gourmet.
Huang Guangyu.
And in my cell, his CFO, Zhou Yafei, was there, and he actually became our number three. We only had a number one and a number two in the room before he arrived. But
you've mentioned that already. What does that mean? There's a very hierarchical pecking order there.
Yeah, there's a in every cell or room, whatever you want to call it. There is there'll be one of the Chinese guys. Oh, it's always Chinese guys. There's a number one and a number two, but the number one is always going to be a Chinese guy who speaks a little bit of English because that's what they value in this wing because they send all the foreigners there, and somebody who gets along with the guard because if he tells you what to do and you don't do it, like, the guard will back him up.
These people they're appointed by the prison, by the jail, excuse me.
They're
the guards.
Well, the each room has kind of a head guard. You know, a guard who's in charge of that room and responsible for that room. And he appoints who's number one and number two. And then this Gourmet CFO, somehow he became number three, even though we didn't have number three until he came around. But he got lots of fluffy blankets and delicious food to eat and stuff like that.
The guards were hoping for a bonus after he got out.
No, I mean, I think that I'm pretty sure that, you know, several people, their wives or family members had relationships with the guards in terms of, I don't know what, but it good enough that they could bring them, you know, extra little gifts and things that they might deliver to their husband.
So at what point were you finally able to make contact with the outside world, with the embassy or your family?
It was my third day, I'm pretty sure. The embassy, a representative from the embassy came to visit me, one of the
consular officers.
Yeah, consular officers. And basically, they lay it down for you, and because I'm sure that every person who's locked up in a foreign prison or jail hopes that when their powerful first world embassy comes to talk to them, that they're going to say, like, we're doing everything we can to get you out. You know, we don't want you here. But that's not what they say. They really say, we're basically here to see that you're being treated fairly in accordance with Chinese law and to communicate with your family. I mean, that's pretty much it. If you're being tortured or anything, you can let us know. You know, we'll help you get packages or get some money from your family if you need money for canteen, that sort of thing, commissary. But beyond that, they're not there to save you. They're just there to, you know, give you a little lifeline to the world, which is really important, though, because there is, I did end up getting a private lawyer. My family did find a private lawyer for me. But most of the foreigners who are locked up in China don't have private lawyers. They get Chinese public defenders, which inevitably leads to convictions. And they have no way to communicate at all with their family or friends. Some people's embassies don't come to see them. And for me, that was the way to communicate with my family. There's no, unlike the United States, when you're in jail or prison, there's no phone calls, there are no letters, there are no visits from family members.
So you weren't Chinese. Given pen and paper? And
no, you can't write a letter. You can't send out a letter at all. I mean, you're totally cut off from the world when you're in jail in China. In prison in China, after you've been convicted and they send you to prison, I believe then you can start to communicate with your family in some ways.
And we'll get to why you weren't actually sent to prison in a little bit. But first, how did you adjust to that first week there? What was it like? What was your daily routine?
It was extremely difficult. I mean, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that was probably the most difficult week of my life in terms of just the raw emotions, just, you know, crying all the time, like just the feeling of utter despair, you know, of being locked up abroad, of having done the stupidest thing in your life and having all of the punishment waiting ahead of you.
And did you feel like this was it? I mean, you were pretty sure that you were going to go do hard time, actually? Or
I was pretty sure. So, I mean, if the first number they threw at me when they were kind of really busting my chops and pushing hard was that it was 15 to life. That was that, you know, that was what the interrogator said to me. And it also turned out when I found out eventually that 2000 grams was the limit between kind of personal possession and being a drug dealer in China, I thought I was really screwed, because when I had bought the hash in Xinjiang, the guy who had sold it to me had told me that each kilo had an extra 50 grams so that I was getting 2100 grams, like to make sure that it wasn't short. And so I was thinking, like, fuck, I'm really fucked. I'm sitting there thinking, man, I know I've got 2100 grams in that package, and I know I must have some more hash in my house, like, you know, in my dresser drawer, in my pocket, lost in a little container. So I did believe that I was going to get convicted. And the other thing, too, is that when you're there is that there is nobody else who is being let free. Everyone else is being convicted around you. There's no hope comes from, you know, people around you who are like, oh, maybe you'll be lucky and end up like me. There's nobody like that. Everybody is getting screwed.
Wow. And so who are some of the other people in the cell? Because you had Zhou Yafei, but what about these foreigners? You said, so maybe what, 12 to 15 people. So it's 6-7 foreigners,
so
yourself excluded.
There were mostly Africans. There were a couple guys from Uganda. There was someone from Zimbabwe, Liberia. Then there was a guy from Iran, and there, after I was there a couple of months, another American actually ended up coming into my cell. But the Africans were there mostly for smuggling heroin, and the guy from Zimbabwe was there for smuggling, I think, 100 kilos of ivory. Wow. And I mean, most of the Africans were found at the airport by X-ray with heroin in their stomach. I can't believe these guys swallow between 1 and 1.5 kilos of heroin in hundreds of balloons and then go sit on an airplane to make a little money. So I actually learned when I was there, like, how I guess a lot of drugs come into China. Even though the drugs are made in, there's a lot of heroin made in Pakistan, Afghanistan, right on China's border. That border is very tightly controlled, and it's not easy to get a lot of stuff over it. But actually, Pakistani businessmen, this is what the guys from Uganda who were actually doing it told me, is that Pakistani businessmen will figure out how to export the heroin from Pakistan
to
Afghanistan to Africa, because it's very easy to get anything into Africa. And then they'll pay Africans to smuggle it all around the world, because Africans are the cheapest people they can find to pay to smuggle stuff all around the world. So
terribly sad.
Yeah, it definitely. And these guys, I mean, if you think I was sad and crying in a Beijing jail, I mean, I had lived in China for more than 4 years at the time. I spoke Chinese. I could make jokes with people. I was familiar with winter. You know, I've lived through winter both in the United States and in China. These guys from Africa, they show up, they get off the plane, they're not in China 5 minutes, and they're in jail, and then they're like live through 20 Beijing winters or something like that. They've never even seen snow. They've never seen ice or something like that. They're,
wow.
These guys are
and
really
they have really no hope of anybody helping them.
They have no hope of anybody helping them. They don't speak any Chinese. Even the food that I could get some pleasure from being used to living in China, and some kind of snacks I could get with my commissary money or something like that, some spicy tofu on a stick or something like that. I mean, it's not going to provide much consolation to a guy from Zimbabwe.
Michael, can you tell us what a typical day was like in Beijing No. 1 Detention Center?
Sure. Well, you would wake up at 6:30 in the morning with a delightful song. I can't remember the exact tune right now, but you know, it's something similar to what you might hear if you live next to a middle school in China, something along those lines. You wake up, we clean up the room, we put away all our beds. So we sleep on the floor. Every single inch of floor space is covered by a person at night. So everyone has to fold up their bedding, pile up the bedding against the walls, kind of get ready for breakfast to show up. And we have breakfast, which was for foreigners. For some reason, there was manto at every meal, but for foreigners...
Manto is steamed bread, right?
Exactly. With no flavor. Like, looks like something delicious, but filled with exactly the same stuff that's on the outside. Just flavorless flour steamed. But they, for some reason, gave us foreigners a loaf of bread in a little bag every morning that came from one of these factories that's like making like European bread.
Bimbo.
something like that. It was almost
kind
like
of really bad, kind of Wonderloaf.
Like
sweet, basically.
Like Wonderloaf type of thing. And they also had, every other morning, you got a hard-boiled egg. And you got a little bit of this really watered-down milk powder that they also gave for foreigners. For some reason, they made some accommodations for foreigners
in
this place.
Well, we need milk and bread, right?
Like, we need milk and bread, exactly. So they gave us...
Everyone got the hard-boiled egg, though.
There was only enough hard-boiled eggs for half the people. So on one day, the foreigners ate hard-boiled eggs, and on the next day, Chinese people ate the hard-boiled eggs. That's how we did it. Yeah. And that was breakfast. After breakfast, we would just go sit on the board. I mean, that's what we call I don't know what actually we would call it.
So describe what the board is.
Okay,
what is this board?
The room is basically, so just imagine a long room and 2/3 of the floor is raised maybe 2 feet off the ground. So you can sit on the edge of it like a bench and you can lie on it kind of, it's probably about 6 feet long. So you can lie on it sort of like a platform at night. But there are too many people in the room just to lie up on that. That's wood. There's a cement floor. So additionally, a lot of people end up sleeping on the cement floor. And I noticed, I know there's much debate over whether Chinese people are racist or not, but I did notice for sure that the Africans were sleeping on the floor.
So you've had your breakfast.
Okay, so we've had breakfast. I mean, basically the main activity in a Chinese jail is sitting on like a bench with no back, basically sitting on the edge of this board. You sit there and you have to sit up. You can't slouch. You can't lean on your knees. You can't fall asleep. There are a whole bunch of things you can't do. You can't lie down on your back. It's not like people think of, at least jail in the United States, where people think of guys kind of lying on their bunk all day, sleeping, listening to music or reading a book or something like that. You have to sit there all day. There was a little reading material in the room, but mostly you just have to do nothing and stare at the wall all day. You can't walk around. You can't play games.
You can't do push-ups. You can't.
No, you can't do push-ups and exercise like that. Only one person at a time can get up to go to the bathroom.
You can't even cross your legs.
You can't cross your legs. Exactly. All that kind of stuff. I mean, depending on who's watching at the time,
And is there somebody watching all the time?
Yeah, I mean, there are guards walking through the hallways, but there are also video cameras on the wall. And I actually could never figure out the whole time I was there where exactly the video camera was, even though I suspected where it was.
So what if you cross your legs? Or what if you lean back? Or what if you, nod off?
Basically, if somebody saw it who was watching from the kind of control center down the hallway, they would push a button and yell at you from a speaker on the wall, kind of like, hey! Like, uncross your legs, or hey, sit up, hey, no sleeping.
Do they call you by name or number?
They call you by name if they know you, but usually, if it's your guard, but the other guards won't know your name.
What did they call you?
When I was teaching English in China, a lot of the students had crazy names like Butterfly, Michael Jordan, things like that. I had a Chinese name at first that I didn't really like. When I chose my own Chinese name, I chose Jingu Bang from Journey to the West, just because I just liked it, and I lived in Xinjiang at the time, and I was born in the year of the monkey, and I don't know.
And if people can be Butterfly or
exactly,
Michael Jordan.
Or Excalibur. I mean, I figured it was the same thing as being named Excalibur.
Right, you can be this expanding stick that the Monkey King keeps in his ear.
Exactly.
Right, why not?
So, and also, it was good for a laugh every single time I told Chinese people my name. Every Chinese person knows that story. I mean, it's like the Bugs Bunny or Sleeping Beauty or something of China. So
that's what they would call you. They'd say, hey, Jingu Bang.
So they'd say something like, Jingu Bang, do this, do that. But so we basically sit there between breakfast and lunch doing nothing, maybe every hour or so.
Were you allowed to talk to other guys?
You could talk quietly. I mean, as long as you were, just not getting crazy. Is that what you did
most of the time?
I
mean, just sort of
I talked to guys. Eventually, over time, the embassy, my family was able to send New Yorker magazines and some books to the embassy. And there were some books already in the room from some previous foreigners who had been there. So I was able to read. I mean, I ended up also reading high school history textbooks and things like that, but it's better than doing nothing. But we would have lunch then at around 10:30 in the morning, and lunch and dinner were pretty much the same thing. Always a boiled vegetable in salty, greasy water, just like the worst possible meal. And I'm sure it met the caloric requirements or something, set by some board. But I mean, literally you could have like boiled cucumbers for lunch in salty, oily water, boiled celery, boiled potatoes. For the last 3 or 4 months that I was there, every single day for lunch, we had boiled salty potatoes for lunch. And then at night you'd have something else boiled and salty, and manto to go with it.
Jesus, that sounds awful.
So, Michael, you have lunch, you have the boiled salty vegetable, and then what are the afternoon's activities?
Well, you know what happens after lunch in China. JL is no different from the rest of China. It's nap time. So we clean up after lunch, and we have an hour to an hour and a half nap. And actually, when we misbehaved, or when we there was actually these times that they called confession times, where they wanted everyone to confess to crimes that they hadn't previously confessed to. They took our naps away, and that would make everybody very cranky. And after that, it was more of the same until dinner. I mean, sitting on the board is what you do all day in a Chinese jail. You
so sit no, there. No exercise time.
You have dinner at about 4:30, again, boiled greasy vegetables and manto. And after dinner is the only free time. You have about 2 hours between from about 5 to 7, 4:45 to 6:45 or so, before the national news comes on at 7. And they let you shower then, exercise. You can just hang out. You could take a nap if you wanted to. So that is that 2 hours is the free time. But everyone has to be sitting on the board. And we actually have to like rotate towards the door and sit cross-legged all on the board to watch the national news and then various terrible Chinese television programming until about 10 o'clock. That's what we do all evening, is sit there and watch TV. And it's controlled centrally. It's not like we get to choose what's on. So it's the news followed by, Chinese variety shows, followed by, a World War II drama and I don't know, circus program, something like that. Typical, flipping through the channels, Chinese programming.
And then that's so...
And you're forced to watch that. You can't not watch. You can't like talk during the TV or like read a book during the TV. Like it's like
you gotta
TV
watch.
Watching time. That's one of the worst.
Until 10, that's pretty late. And then lights out or what?
Yeah, then they tell you to, get ready for bed. Everyone sets up their bed. Brushes teeth, stuff like that, and
did the lights go out though? I mean, that first night they did.
Yeah, what you would call lights out, but they don't turn the lights out, unfortunately, in China. They, I mean, there must be 30-foot ceilings in these cells we were at, and they kind of have stadium lighting hanging down from the top, or something you would see in a supermarket, and they never ever shut it off, like it ever. The only time we were in the dark once was there was some problem with the fans in our room they needed to fix. So they told us to go into our little, there was a little space outside the room where we stored extra goods that was not outside, but it was kind of like a little porch that was surrounded by high cement walls that we kind of went out to at night. That was the only time I was in the dark during the entire time that I was locked.
Were you given any indication of the progress of your case, of the prosecution against you? At all?
No, I mean, you're totally...
You went in March in 2009, and then you didn't get out until October, is that right?
That's right. And, I mean, they could have held me for 7 months and 7 days, and they held me for 7 months and 3 days. So I went through pretty much the entire system of, investigation and deciding whether or not to prosecute you in China. I mean, basically, your first month, they can hold you just to decide whether or not your case has merit to continue holding you. And usually it does. After that, they start 3 2-month cycles which are each investigation cycles. The police investigate you for 2 months. At the end of the 2 months, they pass up all their evidence in their case to the procurator, the prosecutor, and prosecutor decides whether or not to take your case to the judge. So, and then if the prosecutor decides your case isn't strong enough yet, the case against you isn't strong enough, they go through another 2 month cycle, and you can go through 3 of those 2 month cycles. So that's how you get to 7 months.
So, and that's what happened to you then?
I went through all 3 of those 2 month cycles, and at the end of each time, they said that the case wasn't strong enough and they sent it back. And if you get it sent back at the third time, that means you're free. Third time's a charm.
Wow.
And that happened?
And that's what happened. So
you must count yourself very lucky then.
I very lucky. So
it
was more than luck. I mean, I would say that getting out of Chinese jail has, I'm not a religious person, but definitely that moment, like that happening to me, getting out of that situation has made me a much more spiritual person, and definitely believing in just more being there in the universe. You know, some miracle saved me from Chinese prison. There were several miracles, actually. The first miracle was that the 2,100 grams, which I had been promised when I was in Xinjiang for the 2 kilos that I bought to bring back to Beijing,
came up short.
It was actually, after I'd been in there for 2 months, after I was in jail for 2 months, they had to show me this evidence from the lab that had tested, the cannabis, the hash that I had been caught with. And what was sold to me as 2,100 grams actually ended up being 1,970 grams. And then in my house, all of the little bits and pieces that they found added up to 22.56 grams. So my total amount of hash was 1,992.56 grams. And 2,000 was the limit. So as you can imagine, when I saw that number at the bottom of the page, I was like, is this for real? And the investigating officer was kind of like, oh yeah, you must be real happy, huh?
Happy that your buddies, the dealers, screwed you, huh?
Yeah. Or who knows? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, miscalculated or whatever.
And I use that example all the time in my life now. I mean, just tell people when they give me some example of some bad thing that happened to them. Like, I tell them, well, I once got shorted more than 100 grams, like on a big hash deal, and it saved my life. So don't be too worried. There was other things that also, that was not the only thing that saved my life, because I was, you know, just 7.5 grams away from hitting the 2000 mark and automatically getting into that category as a drug dealer. And I had, just the night before, somebody had come over to my apartment in Beijing and purchased 40 grams for me. So if I'd had that 40 grams on me, I also would have been screwed. And also that 40 grams was part of 50 grams, the only 50 grams I had on me. So when I was arrested the next morning, I only had one bag with 10 grams in it instead of 5 bags with each with 10 grams in it, which would be, you know, evidence of...
Okay, you've lost me with the math, but...
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. How did you get through it day to day? I mean, how did you make yourself just sort of endure this? And I guess to follow up on that, what did this make you feel about your whole experience in China? Did you internalize it and feel like, well, I screwed up, this is my fault? Or were you...
I'm still a China lover. I mean, there's this guy on Facebook that I'm friends with, Frank Wang Guan. We used to work at CCTV, and he works for CCTV America now. He's always posting Chinese arguments for why all the various islands and all the various seas belong to them and things like that. And half the time I find myself agreeing with him. So I don't hate China at all. I mean, this was me really messing up. Now, that said, being in jail in China was terrible, but I could have guessed that, from my previous experiences in China. I mean, being on a bus in China is pretty terrible.
Some hotels are pretty terrible.
Yeah, not to make light.
So you've described a day. So you go to bed, the lights are still on. So what happens at night?
So basically from 10 to 6:30 is sleeping time. But the thing that, I mean, I didn't realize and was one of the rudest awakenings, literally, of being in Chinese jail is that you're expected to perform guard duty. Two people at a time have to be awake at any moment. So between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6:30 in the morning, there's always two people standing in the room watching everybody else sleep. And on the first night they let me sleep, thank God, because I was, totally messed up. But the second night they wake me up at midnight and they say, get up. like, you got to do guard duty. It's time to do guard duty. And I'm like, what? I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And you have to stand there in the cold, like not falling asleep while everyone in the room is sleeping with these bright lights on, and just stand there for 2 hours. It's, it might not sound that terrible, but it's really, really terrible to stand there and watch people sleep for like hours and have somebody watching you on a camera on the wall. Like if you lean against the wall, be like, don't lean against the wall. Like, don't fall asleep. What's going on? Get up. And then you, then 2 o'clock comes and some guy on a microphone says, switch shifts, and you wake up the next guy and you go to bed. And the next night at 2 in the morning, they wake you up to stay up till 4. And then the next night after that, they wake you up at 4 in the morning to stay up till 6:30. Then you get a night off, but you have to stay up all night just watching other people sleep. And it's one of the hardest things to get used to, especially at the beginning when you're so messed up and all you want to do is like sleep to kind of get away from your terrible, terrible life that you're experiencing. Wow. And they make you stand there and just watch everybody. Anyways, it's something unique to, and these bright lights, they just never go off. So everybody uses eye masks. They cut off the sleeves of t-shirts and make blindfolds and things like that. But sometimes they'll
thank
come
God you have those.
Take it, but you're not allowed to have them. So sometimes they'll come and take them away or tell everybody to take off their blindfolds and things like that. So it's not pleasant.
No, not at all. So how does that compare with, because you later ended up doing some time in the United States for a similar events. How did the two experiences compare?
Well, as you mentioned, I didn't quite learn my lesson after I came back to the United States without a record from China. I kind of got back into what I was doing all over again, and I ended up getting caught in 2012 with over 100 pounds of weed in New Jersey. And that, I mean, if the first time was the stupidest thing I ever did, the second time was definitely the second stupidest thing I ever did, because I mean, people literally say to you when you come back from an experience like being in Chinese jail, like, I guess you'll never go to jail again. Like, I bet you never do that again. And
then to you do did it
again, to do it again, is fairly embarrassing. So never going back again. Let me just put that out there publicly. Never going back for a third time. But when I came back to the, I mean, I've been involved with cannabis. Since I was in high school, but I worked at High Times while I was in college here in the United States. And obviously in China, I was smoking plenty. And when I came back here to the United States, I worked in New York for a year and then decided to come back out to California and get into the cannabis industry. I mean, I wanted to be part of the real legal cannabis industry that is happening out here. And I, you know, worked a bunch of various jobs, trimming up in the Emerald Triangle, and doing some driving for people. But I ended up starting a delivery service here in Oakland, delivering cannabis to people's homes. And that's what I did. I won some cannabis cups. So I forget what the hell we're talking about. I'm sorry. I don't know where
that,
going
that's what
this
happens when you smoke a lot of cannabis.
I guess it was how you ended up in the clink in New Jersey.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So after I came back from China and I ended up here in California starting a delivery service, but I wasn't quite, well, before I started the delivery service, I didn't have a place to live. I was staying at a friend's house. I kind of didn't have income, you know, the usual reasons that people sell drugs. And I started just doing a little work here and there for some friends, just driving stuff up and down the state, driving some money up and down the state. And then that led to bigger things. And I started bringing large shipments of cannabis to the East Coast and to New Jersey, to New York. And I mean,
this is just in a car.
No. So this was, this was bigger. These were 100, 200 pounds. And we would use shipping containers and, you know, fill it with furniture and hide the cannabis in there and things like that. I mean, it was a more elaborate operation. But I mean, the first time I did it again back in the US, I was again, thinking like, God, this is really stupid. Why am I doing this? Then I had a big pile of money in my pocket, you know, a few days later, and I felt better. And then I did it again and again and got more money and kind of, you know, forgot the regular reasons why people,
get stupid
right, because you're making a lot of money. And I kept on doing that. And the shipping company that we were using here in Oakland, they got suspicious of me because they saw my face one too many times. And one of their dispatchers ended up calling the DEA, and they kind of traced it through to the shipment in New Jersey. And when I arrived there to receive the shipment, I was met by a DEA officer and the Bergen County Narcotics Task Force. And that was a whole nother experience, just like Cops. I mean, just like, what's that movie with Will Smith, Bad Boys? I mean, they came around the corner, 12 cars, you know, heading straight towards me. They stopped 20 feet away. Everyone jumped out with the vests on and the doors open with the guns, like, police, get the fuck on the ground, you know. And yeah, I was caught red-handed again.
So this time you were indicted and...
Yeah. I mean, this time there was no way I was going to get out of it in the U.S. I mean, basically, always from the beginning, it was just looking for the best plea deal. I was never going to go to trial in New Jersey with 130 pounds of weed for them to lie on the table, you know, in front of the jury,
right?
Before they sentenced me. And the way it works in the U.S., I'm sure many people are familiar with it, is that if you go to trial and you lose, you get a really long sentence. If you agree to a plea deal, you get a much more favorable sentence. So, I mean, I ended up getting, even though it sounds bad, I ended up getting 10 years, but I ended up only having to serve two of them. Now, if I had gone to trial, I probably maybe would have gotten 12 or 15 years, but I probably would have had to do 7 to 10 of them. So the math is easy to, in terms of not wanting to go to trial in the United States.
And what were the conditions like in the United States? You're also in jail first, right? And then...
Right. So, I mean, the main difference between the United States and China, I would say, first of all, you have a lot of privacy, a decent amount of privacy in the United States. I mean, for the times that you're locked in a cell with one other person. It's quiet. You kind of have space to think to yourself. The lights go out at night. I mean, that's definitely a big positive. Also, I mean, in China, that food that they served us was definitely like an attempt, part of an attempt to like break your spirit and just like make you, you know, feel the gravity of being in this place. Whereas in the United States, I mean, the food is pretty bad, but it's simulations of all the things you're used to. It's really bad hamburgers, bad meatloaf, really bad pizza. You know, it's kind of like what they serve in school cafeterias, but in maybe two or three levels down from there in terms of quality. But I mean, you're buying hot chips and you got TVs in there and people
are
watching.
And you can do what you want if you...
all day long for the most part, you know, when it's not a time where you have to eat or be locked in your room. I mean, you can go watch TV or you can go sit and read something or you can go lie down on your bed. I mean, basically, you just stare at their hair and they don't care what you do. Whereas in China, they're really just controlling like everything you do all day long. And I mean, the thing that I got out of it was... part of my education on China as a foreigner that was missing from my years of teaching English and doing business and travel writing and working for CCTV was kind of being inside of like a Chinese institution. I mean, not to say that the prisons and the schools are the same because I didn't go to school in China, but I got to feel what it's like to be, you know, punished as a group and treated as a group and really forced into a group dynamic because everything in the room, if somebody does something wrong, the room is punished. If somebody does something really wrong, they might shackle their hands to their feet. And
there's something very distinctly Chinese about this style of rehabilitation, right?
But really about the incarceration is that in the U.S., they're going to like punish you and send you to solitary, you know, if you do something bad. In China, they're going to punish everybody in your room. And so everybody in the room tries to make sure that like the one crazy guy doesn't do something crazy.
Right,
because if they shackle his hands to his feet and he can't wipe his butt, like who's going to have to do it for him? We're all going to have to do it.
Exactly.
Nobody wants to do that. So people behave.
Wow. Yeah. That's quite an illustration of the coercive techniques of peer pressure.
And they're hardcore. I mean, China is more hardcore. They had this program on TV in jail every week that was like produced to kind of show you what other prisoners were doing wrong and like, you know, what you shouldn't do. And it was produced, by some old guy who was a prisoner was the host. And one week they went to this cell and they talked to a guy, and this was in the worst part of the jail. So they went to the cell and they said to the guy, like, what are you here for? And he said, I was here for killing somebody during a robbery. Right. And they said, what was your sentence? And he said, I have suspended death penalty, which means that you have death penalty, but they suspend it to be a life sentence. As long as you don't mess up, basically, while you're incarcerated. And they say, so what did you do? And he's like, oh, I got into a fight in the room. And he says, so what's going to happen now? He's like, oh, now I'm going to get the death penalty. Or like, I mean, I don't know if they executed this guy, but that's the kind of like programs they're showing you there. So it's not like, I mean, it is, you do have fun and you dance around with the guys and, you know, you sing songs and you try to like take your mind off of the terrible conditions you're in. But I mean, they execute people at Beijing Number One Detention Center. They don't execute people at, you know, Bergen County Jail or Northern State Prison in New Jersey. So it just has a different feel.
Wow. Well, Michael, it's been really terrific hearing your stories. And I hope our listeners have found this as intriguing and enlightening and frightening as I have.
Well, don't go to jail in China. That's all I can say.
I have no intention on doing that. Be very, very good. But let's stick around and make a recommendation with us, would you?
Sure.
Sounds okay, good. Great. And before we get to recommendations, we want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at SupChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. Now on to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off.
I'd like to recommend the blog Language Log, which is written by a bunch of different people who are linguists and or have an intense interest in language. There was a post recently, at least recent as of our recording, about Xi Jinping's gaffe during the G20, where he misquoted a Chinese saying.
He
misread the character for Nong, or you know, agriculture, as Yifu was clothes, because the two characters look very similar, to the delight of all the wags on the Chinese internet who mocked him endlessly for being uncultured. There was a particular post that I very much enjoyed about this, but the blog itself is really wonderful, and there's always quite a lot of China stuff on it.
Yes, there is.
So, Language Log.
Good recommendation. Michael, what do you have for us?
All right. I would like to recommend the movie Keanu, which got the worst ratings ever by the critics last year. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the comedy duo Key and Peele.
Yeah, but, I know who they are.
Their movie was severely panned last year. I ended up not going to see it in the theater, even though I really wanted to, because it got like a 1% on Rotten Tomatoes. Anyways, last week I ended up watching the movie and it was pure comedic genius all the way through. People said they held the gag too long. I thought they pushed the gag to genius level. So I tell everybody, please rent Keanu, support the comedians Key and Peele.
I like Key and Peele. I mean, I love them. I love their stuff. I mean, I thought they were genius.
They are genius, for sure.
I'm surprised that I didn't know that movie was so badly panned.
Oh, yeah, it was. Oh, wow, okay. I mean, maybe not go see it. Because yeah. I was like, no. Can I throw another recommendation in there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
All right. I'm gonna go there and recommend CCTV America. I really think that a lot of your listeners out there who may not be as familiar or may not have lived in China as long as we have, they could get a lot from watching CCTV America. There's a lot of crap on there. There's propaganda. But you get the Chinese view and you get it explained in a way that, I don't know, it makes sense. At least you can know what people in China are actually thinking or what the government position is in China. Clearly.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with knowing that. In fact, I encourage that people should understand that better. Great. My recommendation is actually sort of a pre-reading for an upcoming podcast that we're going to be doing with the journalist and writer Bill Lasher. Bill has written a terrific book called Eve of 100 Midnights. It's about a distant relative of his, a guy by the name of Melville Jacoby, or Mel Jacoby, and his newlywed wife, who have marvelous and ultimately quite tragic adventures in China during the Second World War, in the Philippines, and then eventually in Australia. But he first comes to China in 1937, comes back to China soon afterward, and is involved with a huge cast of characters, everyone from Chiang Kai-shek himself to Song Mei-ling to General MacArthur. And T.H. White, the other war correspondent. They were war correspondents during the Pacific War, made a harrowing escape from Manila in the Philippines after Pearl Harbor, and end up on you know, the infamous Bataan Peninsula during MacArthur's efforts to hold out there. Fascinating book, and we really look forward to talking to Bill Lasher. So if you get a chance to read it ahead, you'll be all that much better prepared when we do the podcast. Anyway, thanks again, Michael. That was really, really interesting.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Michael.
The Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn. Special thanks this week to Anla Chang, Amdale Tumililo, and Soraya Darabi from SupChina. drop us an email at Seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast and follow us on Twitter @SenecaPodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.